You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe New Mexican and radiocafe.org, where you can contact us at any time. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. The Radio Cafe is brought to you by the City of Santa Fe Water Conservation. As you know, if you're living here in Santa Fe, we had a warm winter and we didn't get enough snow. The snow brings the water we need, and as a result, New Mexico's drought is currently among the worst in the United States. As the summer heats up, water restrictions in Santa Fe will be coming into effect, and we're being called upon to renew our conservation efforts and learn more about what we can do to value our water. Visit facebook.com/SaveWaterSantaFe to take the City of Santa Fe's new drought online quiz and learn not just about the current condition of the drought, but also how to contribute to long-term efforts to maintain a healthy, green, and water-wise Santa Fe. I'd like now to welcome Mary Beth Pfeiffer. She's an investigative journalist, and she's author of the new book, Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.
So we're producing this show from Santa Fe, New Mexico, and New Mexico is a state where there's relatively little Lyme disease, although there can be issues even here because it's not really on the radar of doctors. So if a patient comes in, they might not recognize the symptoms if someone has contracted the disease elsewhere. But let's talk about Lyme disease on a national level. How prevalent is Lyme disease in the U.S.?
Well, as a matter of fact, a major testing laboratory put out a report just about a month ago in which it reported cases of Lyme disease diagnosed in all 50 states. It is to one degree or another everywhere, but as you say, it often isn't on the radar of doctors. So people may actually contract Lyme in other states, come home and become sick and not get treated properly because doctors are unaware. There are also, though, cases in which doctors really don't recognize homegrown Lyme disease because numbers aren't counted, aren't reported by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, whereas the environment does exist to support ticks. Ticks are brought in by migrating birds and dropped in temperate zones, particularly places where there is vegetation, where there's climate changes, there's a little bit of humidity, there's enough warmth. The ecosystem is correct to support Lyme disease. The mammals are there that are infected. The birds bring in the ticks and so forth, and people hike in the woods, pick up a tick. So yes, it does happen in states where it may not be expected.
In the country, how many cases do we have? I mean, do you count it by year? Do you count it sort of aggregated over a period of years?
Well, the CDC now estimates that there are 10 times as many cases of Lyme disease than are actually reported. So we have about 30,000 a year reported. We had a high of 38,000 a couple of years ago. So we generally say there are about 300,000 a year of cases of Lyme disease in the United States. And that, by the way, has doubled in the last decade. The number of tick-borne diseases has doubled in the United States in the last decade. That's a pretty big leap in terms of cases.
So 300,000 cases a year, and this has been going on for a while, we're talking in the millions.
Very likely. I estimated in my book that there were about 4 million cases of Lyme disease, I believe, since the year 2000. Suffice to say, many people have been infected by this pathogen over time.
So let's talk about what it is. It's a disease transmitted by ticks, often very small ones, whose bites you can't feel because they have this weird little anesthetic that goes through your skin with their biter thing, whatever. But what is the nature of the disease, both the bug itself that causes it and then the symptoms?
Well, as you say, when a tick, a very small tick, perhaps the size of the head of a ballpoint pen, climbs aboard.
Wait, the head of a ballpoint pen? What do
yes.
you mean, the ball in
yes.
the ballpoint pen?
Yes.
The little ball.
Mm-hmm. They often compare it to the size of a poppy seed.
Oh, my goodness.
That's when it's at its most dangerous, in the nymphal stage. A tick has three stages of life. Larval, when it becomes infected, when it first bites an infected animal, usually a mouse. Then it goes on to become a nymph, and that's when it really most frequently infects a human being. And then it goes on to become an adult. And when it's an adult, it's less dangerous to us because, frankly, we can see it. It's somewhat larger. But in the nymph stage, yes, it climbs aboard. It basically does something very interesting. It spits on you. Tick saliva is a thing. It has all sorts of magical properties. And one of them is to numb your skin. So it saws away until it breaks through the skin, and you never feel it. And it takes a while, a few days or so, before you may develop symptoms of Lyme disease. The initial thing that you might see, or maybe not, about 70% of cases exhibit what's called a bullseye rash. It usually has a clear center and it's reddish outside, but it also may manifest itself in different ways. It may be sort of blistery, it may have an irregular outline, there may be more than one of them. So people may miss the rash, or it may not be recognized by either them or by their doctor. Then the other symptoms that might appear are headache, fever, fatigue, intense fatigue, joint pain. These are sort of the classic early symptoms of Lyme disease. So you'll go to the doctor and the doctor will perhaps recognize the rash and immediately order a dose of antibiotics. It's usually 10 to 28 days to eradicate the infection early on. Those are the recommended guidelines, which are a bit controversial. We can talk a little bit about that. But if it's missed and it proceeds to move throughout the body, it can manifest itself in all sorts of ways. You can have it go to the eyes and you have vision problems. It goes to the brain. It can cross the blood-brain barrier. So you can have cognitive issues, depression, mental illness has been associated with Lyme disease. It can become a neurological disease. It manifests itself in different ways, primarily neurological or arthritic. But the neurological cases of Lyme disease are extremely difficult. You can have walking problems, just functioning, coordination, numbness and tingling, meningitis. So this is a disease that really is complex and can be very difficult, especially when it spreads throughout the body.
If it's not caught early, and it often isn't caught early for a number of reasons, which we can talk about, and it's kind of a tragedy because this is a bacterium, so it does respond to antibiotics, but it's also difficult to test for. Why is it so difficult to test for?
Well, the Lyme disease test is an antibody test. In other words, you are infected with the pathogen, and your body proceeds to produce antibodies in response to it. And it takes a while to get enough antibodies, often, to register a positive on the Lyme disease test. Early in the infection, in the first week or two, when your symptoms begin to manifest themselves, you likely won't have enough antibodies to score a positive on the test. Something like 40% of people correctly test positive. So there you have 60% who don't, but who are sick. So the philosophy that has governed diagnosis of this disease is, okay, you don't test positive right away, we're going to wait. And we let the pathogen move throughout the body, produce more antibodies, and test later. That is a flawed philosophy and guiding principle, especially when it comes to Lyme disease, because you really don't want to let this pathogen move throughout your body. It has these abilities and talents, if you will, that many bacteria do not. It is a coil-shaped, a corkscrew-shaped organism with an internal flagella, the thing that propels bacteria. So it can drill through tough joint cartilage. It can wend its way into your muscles, into your eyes. As I said, it can cross into the brain. And it very quickly leaves the bloodstream. So it can't be found in a culture test. We look for it. It's not there. It's already gone. So we really don't want to let this thing proceed because, yes, we do know that as the infection proceeds, the test gets better. But by the same token, you've allowed the infection to progress into the body, into other places of the body.
And it's an absolutely harrowing disease. I mean, there's a heartbreaking story in your book of a young man, a boy really, who was an African-American kid who got the disease, died of it.
Yes.
It was undiagnosed. And then when they tested him after death, it's like, oh yeah, he had Lyme disease. Well, his parents knew that before. But because he had dark skin, the rash didn't show up. So
yes.
There's a lot of, I mean, the people who are kind of conservative and probably over-conservative about Lyme diagnosis and treatment say, well, you have to have the rash and a positive test, but often the rash can't be seen or it doesn't show up or it's not the typical rash. The test, as you say, in 60% of cases doesn't show up. What is the thinking on your part and on the part of doctors who favor a more aggressive approach to Lyme disease on figuring out whether a person really has it and then treating?
Well, you're referring to the case of Joseph Elone of Poughkeepsie, who was a local case for us. And he had gone away to summer camp, came home, and was very sick in short order. He's a classic example of the failure of the Lyme disease tests. His parents had brought him to his pediatrician twice. He had some of the classic symptoms of Lyme disease. He had fever and headaches. He had intense fatigue. But he also had some other things like chest congestion and some stomach issues. So the doctor, for one reason or another, decided that this didn't really look like Lyme disease. Did test him for Lyme disease, and he tested negative because it was too early in the infection. Now, in that case, I would argue that it would have been prudent to give him a short course of antibiotics, antibiotics being among the safest drugs there are. He had gone to camp in a prime Lyme disease state, namely Rhode Island. It was summertime. He was manifesting flu-like symptoms. But the doctor didn't treat because I believe this is part and parcel of the larger picture of Lyme disease. We have minimized this disease. We have framed it in American medical journals and in the guidelines that basically define Lyme care as easy to diagnose, easy to treat. Those guidelines say at three different points that you need either a Lyme disease rash or you need a positive test to treat. And one of the places that it says that you need one of those two things is for Lyme carditis, when the spirochete goes to the heart. That's what happened to Joseph. He was infected in his heart. It produced something like a heart block. It interrupted with the rhythm of the heart. And this 17-year-old boy, who was an honor student, who had every indication of being highly successful in life, who loved nature,
wanted to be an ecologist,
wanted to go into ecology, he basically collapsed one day in front of his home on his lawn, and within about 10, 12 hours, he was declared dead.
So this is a kind of a medical battle between agencies like the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, and the IDSA, the Infectious Disease Societies of America, who say that Lyme disease, as you say, is not that big a deal. It's easy to diagnose and to cure. It actually is kind of easy to cure if you get it early, but it's not so easy to diagnose. And then there's this other side, which is patients and their families who are shattered by the disease and doctors who see what's going on. How are these battle lines drawn? How could this have come into being?
That's a really good question. You know, we definitely do view Lyme disease as easy to cure. That 10 to 28 days of antibiotics, particularly administered early, will eradicate the infection.
Is that true?
Well, that's what I'm getting to, because there is a lot of evidence to refute that. But it's so firmly entrenched in the mainstream dogma that the new science that has come along hasn't been able to displace it. Not yet, anyway. I think that's going to change. There's a strange irony, a dichotomy in Lyme disease, because while the mainstream side maintains that this short course of antibiotics will eliminate the infection. It also acknowledges, and these are in mainstream journals by the guideline authors and by the major scientists who rule this Lyme dogma, they acknowledge that 10 to 20% of patients will remain ill for a year or more after having Lyme disease, after being treated for Lyme disease. What they maintain, and this is the heart of the controversy over Lyme disease, is that those people no longer have active infection. The Lyme disease spirochete has been eliminated from their system. So that's why they've kind of stuck to this, you know, short courses work. We're not going to consider anything else. But there has been science for at least 20 years that has challenged that. The first paper, perhaps, was a test in which they infected beagles with the Lyme disease spirochete. And then they treated the dogs with antibiotics, the same ones that you and I would get. And they found, when they looked into the bodies of these beagles, that indeed, in some of them, the Lyme disease spirochete persisted. That was sort of brushed aside, even though we were finding all along that many people were remaining ill. And then about 5 years ago, a whole spate of new research began, in which scientists infected monkeys and mice and found, lo and behold, that when they euthanized these critters, and we can't do that with people to find the Lyme disease spirochete, they found the spirochete in the brains of mice, in the hearts, in the various organs and cartilage and so forth. They also have done a lot of studies in which they've just taken the Lyme disease bug and put it into test tubes and tried to kill it with antibiotics. And they have found that it's really hard to kill all of the organisms. So this is the new kind of wave of findings that is really challenging that Lyme disease paradigm that rules in America.
It's a really nasty bug.
It is. It has among the most complex genomes of any bacteria out there. We are still kind of in the very early stages of trying to figure out its various capabilities. But it can do things like it gets in the body and it drops some of the genes that might signal to our immune system. It changes its outer surface proteins, so that whereas our immune system might recognize it for what it is, it tricks our immune system into thinking it's something else. And our immune system doesn't do the thing it needs to do, namely fight it. So it has a lot of abilities, and evolution-wise, it's kind of way ahead of us in terms of survival.
It's hard to understand why the scientific bodies, like the Centers for Disease Control and so on, whose entire mission is to keep society healthy, would minimize this disease. Is there a follow-the-money angle in this? Is there a vested interest in not diagnosing and treating? What's going on?
Well, you know, I'm asked that question a lot, and I can only say that they have their set of science that upholds the dogma that they embrace. We've done clinical trials to see if these people who have persisting symptoms of Lyme disease can be cured of those symptoms by giving them longer courses of antibiotics. The first two in 2001 gave people 3 months of a combination of intravenous and oral antibiotics. And at the end of those 3 months, the conclusion was that these people didn't get better. So they stopped the trials and they immediately, early actually, released the findings because they wanted people to know it was the summer season. They rushed to publication that long-term antibiotics don't work. Then there were two more studies, and basically the same regime of treatment was used, and similar conclusions were drawn, but not identical. The overall conclusion of the mainstream side was that this did not work. Well, you know, fast forward a few years, people have revisited those trials and have found them to be flawed in various ways. Statistically flawed. And even in one case, the author of one of those papers and the prime scientist who led one of the trials said that his own findings were underestimated, that people actually did improve. So there are reasons to question those four trials. The trials also revolved around the same antibiotics and the same length of treatment. And Lyme disease doctors who are trying to figure this disease out basically try a lot of other things, different antibiotics. They always use probiotics as well to minimize the bad reactions. And, you know, they're finding a measure of success that were not found in these trials.
So basically what's on the ground is showing up different from those fairly limited number of studies.
Right. And those limited number studies have so defined the way we treat Lyme disease that mainstream doctors aren't really willing to try anything else. You have this core group of Lyme disease doctors who, by the way, have been called quacks, have been vilified by the mainstream side, who are trying to figure it out, who see that their patients come in very ill and often improve over months.
With sort of taking longer-term antibiotics.
Yes, but I would add here that antibiotics are not the panacea. They're not the answer to this problem. The answer to this problem is to recognize that we need to go back to the drawing board. We need, yes, to draw on the experiences and the findings of these Lyme disease doctors who have had success using other drugs, not just antibiotics. In one case, a doctor used a leprosy drug to treat people and found some success with that. The doctors also use herbal treatments. They change people's diets. They try and remove mold from their homes. They have a very kind of inclusive way of looking at Lyme disease holistically. And, you know, I would also add that that often doesn't fit into the model of American medicine.
Right. Is there any demographic that's more likely to get Lyme disease or less likely? I imagine people who never go outdoors are
yes.
Not likely to get it, but...
Well, children from 5 to 14 years old are the most frequently infected group. I've spoken to many parents whose children have had long seizures with Lyme disease in which they've missed months of school and years of childhood. The second most frequently infected group are people 50 to 64 years old. I think these are the people who are most likely to be outdoors. You know, you've got the children playing at one end and the people hiking and gardening at the other end, I think. In between, it's a serious problem for all age groups. But people who put themselves out there, who brush up against a little bit of tall weeds or weed a Pachysandra patch, those are the folks who are going to come into contact with ticks and, frankly, need to be really careful to check themselves after they go outside.
One of the painful ironies of this, and you describe this in your book, is that people who love the outdoors, especially in high Lyme disease areas like in the Northeast, really have to come to fear the places that they love the most. And you've had this experience yourself.
Yes, I live in a rural area of the Hudson Valley in New York. And behind my home, I have a beautiful 9-acre field. And we actually mow a path around the field to make it safe to venture into. But I look at that field with different eyes than I did 30 years ago. When I moved to the Hudson Valley from New York City, there weren't any ticks, or there was hardly any ticks. It was a very rare event when you had a tick on you. And I did in my ear, the curve of my ear at one point after jogging through a field. These days, if you actually venture into that tall grass at the wrong time of year, you can come out with a dozen ticks on you. I've had that happen with my dogs. I took two dogs for a short walk a couple of years ago and picked 42 ticks off of them.
Oh my goodness.
And you know, this is a new phenomenon because it's a new world.
And we'll get to that in a few minutes because this is really a climate change story underneath everything. But I want to stay with the disease for a moment because another piece of this is that there are many other diseases besides this spirochete bacterium that you were talking about that are carried by ticks. And I have to say, as I was reading this book, I felt like I was watching a super creepy monster movie with the tick as the villain, you know, invasion of the tick people kind of thing.
Yes.
These other diseases are just as horrible and actually can create a terrible synergy with Lyme disease. Tell us what all that looks like.
Yes, well, a Drexel University scientist who reviewed my book, who endorsed it, basically likened it to a Stephen King novel.
Yeah.
All the more scary because it's actually true. Yes, ticks are carrying not just Lyme disease. Where I live, about 30 to 60% of ticks will be infected with Lyme disease. But the next sort of up-and-coming or most frequently found organism in ticks is Babesia. It causes babesiosis, which is very much like malaria. It will not respond to antibiotics. It is a very nasty bug. And, you know, night sweats, fevers, intense lethargy. And when you get Babesia and the Lyme disease pathogen, which is called Borrelia burgdorferi, in the same bite, you will have a much more severe course of illness than if you get either one alone. Moreover, doctors often don't know to look for Babesia beyond looking for Lyme disease. You know, they see a rash, they think Lyme disease, they test perhaps, or they give a course of antibiotics. They shouldn't test if the rash is there, but they may not actually treat for the other problem that exists, which is babesiosis. Other organisms that are in ticks can also cause severe illness, such as anaplasma, which causes anaplasmosis, and it can be very serious. There have been deaths reported, particularly in the elderly. The other thing that we're really watching for right now is Powassan virus. Again, not amenable to antibiotic treatment. It's a very severe neurologic illness that kills in about 10% of cases. It's particularly scary because the infection can be delivered with a bite that lasts only 15 minutes. If you found the tick within 15 minutes, you may still be infected with Powassan virus. That said, it's not very common right now, maybe in 1% of ticks where I live.
Another part of, and I'll call it a scandal because it really does seem quite scandalous, is that many doctors, even if there's a suspicion of Lyme disease and associated tick diseases like the ones you were just talking about, and a rash, and the person is an outdoors person, all of these risk factors for Lyme disease, the doctor will see it as a psychological problem. And the person might have never had psychological problems, and they're, you know, happy and strong and athletic, and suddenly they're just laid flat by this thing, and they'll get prescribed antidepressants. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems both insane and really irresponsible.
That was really one of the first things that tipped me off to there's something wrong with this picture when I began as an investigative reporter to look into Lyme disease in 2012. I had been an investigative reporter for about 3 decades in the Hudson Valley, which has among the world's highest rates, before I got around to looking at Lyme disease. And the reason it took me so long is because I had the same view of Lyme disease, I think, that the mainstream medical community has. It's not a big deal. We have a test for it. We have treatments for it. No big problem.
You'd had it yourself, right?
I had it myself, and I was quickly treated, and it wasn't anything prolonged. So I kind of fit into that model. I was one of those people treated at a golden time. I was one of the lucky ones. But then as I started to interview people, I found people who went to 5, 10, 15 doctors trying to get care after they had continuing symptoms of Lyme disease. And they were often told they had anxiety, they were given an anti-anxiety medication. They were told they were depressed, they were given an antidepressant. Well, they finally made their way to a doctor who recognized that this was ongoing Lyme disease and treated them, and they got better. They improved. They may not have gotten cured because it was so advanced, but they did get better. And this all goes back to that easy to treat, minimize Lyme disease mentality that exists in America. And one of the ways I also found that that manifested itself in the scientific literature, the literature that guides the way doctors think and practice, is that I found in the literature a lot of discussion of overdiagnosis of Lyme disease. I found 30 scientific papers that were dedicated to false positives. I could only find 5 papers to underdiagnosis. Now, that is a tip-off that there's a problem with our test, first of all. But secondly, the emphasis has been on don't falsely diagnose Lyme disease. Be wary of a false diagnosis. This goes back to the problems that happen when a person is falsely diagnosed as not having Lyme disease. The disease progresses, the person becomes more sick. So weigh that against the very low risk of treating that person. And I would argue that antibiotics are safe. We often give them in short courses for other things when we're trying to figure out what they're suffering from. But somehow this line in the sand has been drawn for Lyme disease.
Now, there's a lot of discussion of overuse of antibiotics and the creation of resistant strains and superbugs and stuff like that. Does that play a role in this conversation?
It has basically been found that the Lyme disease pathogen itself does not morph into superbugs. There have been studies basically showing that it will not mutate into something more powerful or fearsome than it is because it's exposed to antibiotics. There is a case to be made that you don't want to give antibiotics willy-nilly because it will make us resistant
right.
to other treatments that we may need. So yes, we should not use antibiotics when they're not needed. We shouldn't overuse antibiotics because they're not good for our guts. But I think there's plenty of evidence to suggest that we have underdiagnosed Lyme disease, that we've undertreated it because of the people who remain ill, because of science that is showing the Lyme disease pathogen outwits antibiotics as we are using them for this disease.
And the trade-off, which for a person who has used antibiotics, and I think probably most of us listening to this show have at one point or another used antibiotics, and we have to deal with the gut problems and replenishing, and there is a whole set of conversations around, you know, as we discuss on this show, how to deal with a gut that's been compromised, and that mm-hmm. leads to all sorts of problems. But the trade-off between replenishing and restoring your microbiome on the one hand and dealing with long-term chronic Lyme disease, mm-hmm. it's kind of a no-brainer.
I would think so, yes. And the physicians who treat long-term Lyme disease always, without exception, use courses of probiotics, the best probiotics that are out there. And, you know, I was trying to think of times that I got antibiotics from my physician. Not once have I been told to take a probiotic along
Right.
with the antibiotic. So, you know, they are trying to balance those risks.
Your book is called Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. Let's talk about the climate change angle. What's the link between ticks and climate change?
Well, I think people who live in Lyme disease areas know that there are ticks now where there weren't before.
Or a lot of ticks. I mean, I remember growing up and having my dog had ticks from time to time, and we would pull them out or try to burn them off and put them in nasty whatever, like lighter fluid or whatever. But it was kind of a normal part of life.
And back then, that was the dog tick primarily. Now what we have is the black-legged tick. And scientists are observing in many countries that these ticks are moving north. They're on basically a northward march in the northern hemisphere. And similar ticks that import tick-borne diseases like Lyme disease are moving south in the southern hemisphere. And basically what we have is correlations. We have archival data in Sweden, for example, where ticks were able to live at a certain latitude 30 or 40 years ago. Now scientists are seeing they are moving north. We are seeing that happen in Finland. We're seeing that happen in Canada. There have also been studies that show that, for example, in the Alps in Bosnia 40 years ago, a resourceful scientist climbed up, took a census of ticks, found that they lived at 800 meters on this mountain, no higher. Another scientist goes back just a few years ago, finds them living at 1,200 meters. We see that it's warmer in those places. It's not just warming, though. climatologically, you're seeing a lot more humidity in many of these places, and black-legged ticks need humidity to survive because they dry out very quickly in dry environments. Beyond climate change, though, beyond a warmer world, we've also changed the world in many ways. And these adulterated environments that we live in really support this whole cycle, this whole ecosystem that is very friendly to ticks. So an adult tick basically finds that there's lots of deer out there, and the deer are where the tick goes to meet a mate, to live out its life mission of making more ticks. It drops off the deer, it lays 2,000 or 3,000 eggs. The next spring, those eggs hatch, and basically the larval ticks will find something else in the environment. It's going to find lots and lots of mice. You know, at one point we might have had foxes to keep those mice under control. No more. Because we have these fragmented bits of forest that are cut up by development, cut up by roads, aren't quite in their natural state. So this larval tick finds all these mice, and guess what? The mouse is where this baby tick goes to get its first meal as well as its first dose of Lyme disease.
Yet another argument for keeping predators in the environment. They keep not only, you know, mice from coming into your house and eating your food, you know, things like that, but they keep Lyme disease at bay.
Yes.
Or tick-borne diseases in general.
And they have found where there are more foxes, there's less Lyme disease because there's fewer mice. I'm not sure we can undo what we've done to the environment, though. It's so big. It's on such a large scale. We're trying, for example, to put out these bait boxes for mice. I call it like a little car wash for mice. They go in this little door. They get doused with a little bit of insecticide. They get a little tasty treat, which keeps them coming back. It kills the ticks on them. So we're now studying to see whether that's going to control some of the Lyme disease in our case counts. There's also another study that combines both the bait boxes and spraying residential properties with a fungicide to kill ticks. So we really have to get a handle on how to control ticks in the environment. Other endeavors are looking at putting corn out for deer. Not that you want to feed and support the deer population, but when the deer go to these places, these stations to eat, they too will be doused with some sort of insecticide that'll kill the ticks on them. We also likely have to do some more to control the population of deer in the environment. Some more hunting, some culling of deer, maybe even some sterilization of deer.
Yeah.
This has to be attacked at a lot of different fronts to really bring it under control, and it's going to cost money.
Well, and I want to get to that in a moment because there are ways to deal with this, but staying with the ecosystem piece for just a moment, there's a very sad description at the beginning of your book about moose, and this isn't even about Lyme disease and tick-borne illnesses. It's just about ticks, the proliferation of ticks, and what they're doing to moose populations.
Yes, that was a really, for me, horrifying education in the damage that has been done to the environment. And primarily in the Midwest and in the Northeast and also parts of Canada, the moose population is endangered. One of the main threats to the moose population is something called winter ticks. Now, these are ticks that don't attack people, don't make us sick, but they are out there in such profusion that one moose might have 100 or 150,000 ticks on its body. And they call these ghost moose because what they do is they have so many ticks on them that they rub up against trees to try and get the ticks off, and big, big patches of fur will come off with that. They rub so hard and so long. So they have these mottled patches, these grayish patches on them, and they're called ghost moose. There can be so many ticks on one moose that it will take half of the volume of a moose's blood. It's amazing. And what you're seeing in these areas are very sick moose. They have anemia. They're wandering onto roads. They're getting hit by cars. They're simply laying over and dying. The other thing about this is a moose gives birth to babies. the ticks move from the mama moose right onto the baby moose.
And they're even more vulnerable.
Yes, and there's very high mortality among the baby moose these days in those places.
And what kept it in check before was the temperature?
This is believed to be an outgrowth of climate change in much the way that ticks have proliferated elsewhere.
So let's now talk about the money piece. Funding for Lyme disease is remarkably low compared to, say, the Zika virus, which has far fewer cases but gets more funding, especially when that outbreak recently occurred. And it reminds one of the AIDS epidemic and AIDS funding in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president and the U.S. didn't fund AIDS early on and thereby missed a huge opportunity to cut the epidemic off before millions of lives were lost. Do you see, first of all, is that a valid analogy? And do you see any signs of change on the funding front?
There's a very significant parallel between Lyme disease and AIDS, insofar as when they emerged early in the 1980s, that's when both of those pathogens were first identified as the cause of illness in their individual populations. But the parallel sort of diverges after that. What you had for AIDS is, took a few years, but it happened, medicine and government geared up. They responded to this threat.
Well, and they responded to activists who went absolutely after them.
Right, and these years, those few years that it took to happen, there was a lot of agitation, there was a lot of protest and so on. And a lot of money was put to the task. Laboratories were founded. PhD programs were minted. You had a lot of effort on the science end to try and figure out what was going on. And lo and behold, we found an answer to AIDS. It is now a chronic illness. It is not the threat it was where you had 50,000 people dying a year. Now, you can also say that Lyme disease doesn't have that kind of mortality rate. And it's true. But people are suffering, thousands of people are suffering from Lyme disease, and they are added to the count year after year. That 10 to 20% who remain ill a year or more after treatment, that's 30 to 60,000 people a year. One study found that after 15 years, 5% of people were still suffering from Lyme disease. That would be 15,000 people a year compounded for 15 years. Huge numbers. We also do have people dying of Lyme disease. We have Lyme disease suicides. We have Lyme carditis. We have people dying of other things that are not recorded as Lyme disease because Lyme manifests itself in so many different ways. People are diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, with rheumatoid arthritis, with ALS in cases.
But it's really Lyme.
But it's really Lyme disease. So what I argue is that we haven't put the money to this task. We have evidence of people suffering on a very large scale, but we haven't devoted the money to this because of the way Lyme disease has been framed as easy to diagnose, easy to treat.
If the money were there, what could be done to reduce or eradicate Lyme and other tick-borne illnesses?
We could do more clinical trials, for example. We have to go back to the drawing board. Are we adequately treating it even early on? Most people will get over it with a short course of antibiotics, as I did, as my husband did. But we do know that even those people treated early, a share of them will remain ill. We have to come up with a better test. There are tests that are out there that have been studied that work better than the tests that we have. But for some reason, a new test has not been able to break through. Again, the dogma. I blame it on that. So we just have to rethink this disease. And, you know, on the positive side, we are doing that to an extent. A task force is meeting in Washington right now. It was formed under some legislation that was passed a few years ago at the intense lobbying of legislators from Lyme disease tests, and it's called the Tick-Borne Disease Working Group. And it's being managed by the Department of Health and Human Services in Washington, and it's basically taking a top-to-bottom look at how we treat Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases in America. And it brings together both sides of that huge Lyme divide. This is a very good development in terms of the future.
Now, you describe in the book a response to Zika virus that involves kind of re-engineering mosquitoes so that they produce only male offspring. And of course, mosquitoes reproduce very quickly, and they have a much shorter life cycle and so on. Ticks, not so much. But still, is there that kind of a possibility with ticks?
Well, the idea would be to genetically engineer ticks so that they would only produce males. And that would certainly curtail the proliferation problem that we have. Yes, I did speak with scientists who said that's a possibility. Right now, there is a project out of MIT in which a scientist by the name of Kevin Esvelt is trying to genetically engineer mice. And basically, the idea would be to create a mouse that is genetically vaccinated, if you will, against Lyme disease. In other words, a tick bites that mouse and it doesn't contract the pathogen, it doesn't carry the pathogen, and then infect more ticks. So they're trying this basically on islands off of Massachusetts. They may also do it on Martha's Vineyard, I believe. It's a long way off. It holds some potential. But the problem with that is, as we discussed, there are other pathogens carried by ticks.
Yeah.
Might Babesia become a much bigger problem if the Lyme disease bug is no longer in circulation? Who knows what the upshot of that will be? It's also a very tall order to go from working on a small contained landmass in the ocean to putting it on the mainland and assuring that every mouse out there, or at least, you know, a large proportion of them, have this genetic marker that will fight the Lyme disease bug.
What about vaccinating us?
Well, there was a vaccine from 1998 to 2002 that was on the market, and something like 1 million people were vaccinated. And what happened was there were a lot of side effects. There was a class action lawsuit. People got very sick. But I would add here that it was a very small proportion of people. A scientific paper was published, which basically said the number of people who had bad effects to this vaccine were within the expected range. Many people did not accept that as legitimate. And incidentally, within 2 or 3 days of that paper being published, the vaccine was pulled from the market. So there is a vaccine in development now. It will likely come on the market within the next couple of years. But again, I would say it's a highly imperfect solution to this problem.
Yeah.
It may make people complacent and make them think they can go out in that field that's riddled with ticks still and that they're protected. There are other things in those ticks that these people will not be protected against. The other question is, will it be safe? We really don't know the answer to that yet.
Do ticks have any redeeming value? Do they play a positive role in ecosystems? Are they a major food source for some other species? I mean, they don't pollinate. What do ticks do besides make us miserable?
Well, I did pose that question to a number of scientists, and frankly, they could not come up with any real reason to have ticks in our environment. Yes, some birds do eat ticks. Guinea fowl will eat ticks. Chickens will eat ticks. There's a bird in Africa called the oxpecker. That's the one that you see sitting on the back of a very large animal, I think a bison-like animal, and it'll peck at the skin of the bison if there's a tick there or if there's not, in order to drink blood. But, you know, that tick and that regime is not instrumental to the survival of that bird. So no, we really don't know of any true and integral role that ticks play in the web of life.
What are your hopes for this book?
My hopes for this book are to redefine the way that we see Lyme disease, to recognize that we have had a role in moving ticks around the planet, that this is a product of what we call the Anthropocene. We are in that era of worldly development in which the hand of human beings has made a huge mark. And beyond that, it's to redefine Lyme disease in terms of the way we view it. that we have not gotten this disease right, that we have a lot to figure out about it, how to diagnose it, how to treat it, how to control it going forward. So it's a small goal, but there it is.
Mary Beth Pfeiffer is an investigative journalist, and she's author of the book, Lyme, The First Epidemic of Climate Change. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community, and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.